It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The University of Pittsburgh has begun its fall semester remotely. On-campus classes are scheduled to begin the middle of September. One of the classes is a mandatory Black Studies course. On the line is Dr. Yolanda Covington Ward, chair of the Department of Africana Studies. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin.
When we spoke just a couple months ago, a spring 2020 grad, Sydney Massenburg, had launched a petition to require all undergrads to take a class in Black Studies as a graduation requirement. Did you expect that initiative to be so successful so quickly?
I really did think that there was going to be something to come out of it. She played a huge role in making this new course a possibility, but she wasn't the only person. In fact, a number of Black student organizations came together under the Black Senate and presented a list of an action plan to the university, and having a mandatory class was also one of their demands as well.
Who usually takes your classes in Africana Studies? Is it mostly students of color?
In fact, no. Our classes in Africana Studies are attended by students from a number of different backgrounds. And so we have students who are African-American, we have students who are Asian, we have white students, we have students from all different backgrounds who are in our classes, because students are going into a number of careers where they'll be engaging with and interacting with Black people from different backgrounds. These courses are really valuable for them, whether you're going into social work, whether you're becoming a teacher, or even a lawyer. You're going to be interacting with different kinds of people. And so understanding people's histories and backgrounds is really important.
So let's get into what will be taught. Will you give us some idea of how you'll dive into Black history and culture?
I wanted to at least lay out what the course covers first. So the title of the course is Anti-Black Racism, History, Ideology, and Resistance. And this course itself wasn't just designed by me. I'm the head of the committee, but we were a committee of 11 faculty members and one student, actually, one undergraduate student who put together the syllabus for the course. And the things that we cover, we talk about understanding pre-colonial African history first. We also talk about the concept of race. That's, in fact, the first lecture. We talk about pre-colonial African history and then the history of enslavement, which was really, really important, lasting for several centuries and having a huge impact on race relations in this country and across the world, actually. And then we also talk about a number of other things, contemporary Black liberation movements, in which we have several national speakers who are related to the Black Lives Matter and the Movement for Black Lives movements. We have people talking about racist housing policy in the United States and looking specifically at how that impacted Pittsburgh, for the Hill District in particular. We have a number of different topics that really are designed to encourage students to understand how anti-Black racism works at multiple levels.
So, will you address the protests against racial injustice that are happening just about every day?
Definitely, because that's also one of the motivations for the course. So in addition to the students' demands for the course, this is all coming from the national attention to racial injustice that's happening, of course, spurred by the killing of George Floyd, but also so many others like Breonna Taylor, like Ahmaud Arbery, but also locally like Antoine Rose here in the Pittsburgh area. And that is also a part of some of the lessons throughout the entire semester.
So what does being anti-racist mean?
So being anti-racist is really about taking proactive measures to address how you can act against and speak out against racism in your everyday life. So it's not enough to just be say that you're not racist, but it's to be anti-racist is to proactively look to address these issues. So for example, if you see a policy that is impacting people of color disproportionately, being able to speak up and say something about it. If you are in your everyday life encountering bias against people that may not be impacting you, but you see it being unfairly leveled against others, speaking up and saying something about it. Oftentimes decisions about who has access to opportunity or how different communities are going to be impacted are not made by people in those communities. So you have to be able to address and directly engage with being anti-racist yourself in everyday life in order to affect change.
I'm sure you've heard people say, we don't see color. I don't teach my kids to see color. But is that enough?
Kevin, it's definitely not enough. Because one thing that people often say is if you don't see color, then you don't see me. People are definitely treated differently because of their skin color. There are particular assumptions that are made about people's income, about criminality, about education levels that are based on a set of stereotypes, but are leveled against people, you know, whether or not they want to engage with it. There are ways in which it comes into their lives and they have to deal with it. You can say you don't see color, but then when you look at U.S. housing policy that explicitly redlined Black communities and has an impact on home values to this day, you have to address how that's impacted the lesser amount of wealth that African Americans have been able to accumulate through their homes. Not seeing color does not make these inequities go away. And so you have to address them.
How important is it that what is taught doesn't stay in the classroom, that it's shared by the students with family and friends?
I think it's very important for people to try and share, and for our students to try and share what they're learning. Not everyone has the benefit of access to higher education, unfortunately. This is also a part of the reason why this course in particular tries to get students to think about how they can be proactive. We have one unit dedicated to how to be anti-racist, like how to be anti-racist in your everyday life. So again, trying to come up with strategies that you then can use that you also can pass on to others. And so in this way, knowledge can be shared because it's only through sharing this knowledge and sharing these practices that small changes can happen and lead to larger changes.
Dr. Yolanda Covington Ward is chair of the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. At his recent campaign stop in Pittsburgh, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden said, quote, "More cops have died from COVID this year than have been killed on patrol." It depends on whether you include corrections officers, border patrol agents, and others, and what he meant by on patrol. But a fact check by the Philly Inquirer found the comparison to be largely accurate. So that got us thinking, what steps are being taken to protect Pittsburgh police officers from COVID? Chris Tonieri is the public information officer for the Department of Public Safety. Chris, each day from the Allegheny County Health Department, we get updates on the numbers of new cases of COVID-19. Does public safety keep track on the number of police officers who've been infected by the virus?
I don't have the total number from going back to March. I do know that we get daily updates listing current personnel. And public safety-wide, there's currently one person who has tested positive. I know that in the past, a few months ago, there was a small outbreak at the affecting some people at the police academy. I believe that there were about five people who tested positive. But overall, Pittsburgh police have really, the numbers have been low. And that's the same for all departments in public safety. We're fortunate and we're thankful. But we also believe that we've been very proactive in providing people with PPE and social right. distancing. So we've been very proactive in fighting this, and I think that's one reason why the numbers have stayed low.
You mentioned police, but what about paramedics? I mean, these folks really get involved. I mean, hands-on treatment of Pittsburghers.
EMS numbers have also been very low. One of the reasons why is because of the screening process that goes on. When medics go to a home or out on a 911 call, the screeners, identify whether there is known COVID at that residence and flag certain cases where an ambulance, especially equipped ambulance with full PPE, they'll send those units instead of a regular ambulance. They're really not taking any risks.
So does the police bureau conduct tests?
So police, this is not just police, but it's every department in public safety. Everyone is screened before they can enter any facility. That's at police headquarters, at any of the police zones. You must have your temperature taken. You are asked a series of questions to find out whether or not you've been experiencing any symptoms. If you're feeling ill, you are automatically sent to self-quarantine. If you've been exposed, you are automatically sent to self-isolate. And if you're not feeling well, you're just asked to not come in.
In addition to those precautions that you're taking. We do know that a lot of people are asymptomatic. So is there a mask requirement when officers and other personnel go out into the public?
Not just when they go out in public. There is a mask requirement for any time you are in a public safety facility. So all firefighters, all medics, all police officers, when you walk around police headquarters, you're required to wear a mask. In addition, social distancing is required at all times possible. I don't think it's really much different than what most people are experiencing. I think that the difference is when you have a police officer responding to a call, social distancing obviously is not always possible, but they are expected to wear masks at all time. And if there is if they're responding to a call where there is a known COVID exposure, that is when the special units from EMS are also called to the scene.
What's the policy for when officers are out covering protests? There's been some video from protesters that show officers without masks.
Like I said, the requirement is for all officers to be wearing masks. That came from Chief Schubert. So we get that, especially in the PIO office. People love to take photos of public safety officials not wearing masks and send it to us and say what's going on. And they are always addressed. So there have been reminder memos sent out to people saying, hey, you are expected to wear masks when out in public. I'm not going to say that it's been 100% adherence, but the reminders are out there and officers are expected to be wearing masks.
Are those reminders going out system-wide, department-wide, or do they go to the individual officers if you're able to identify them?
Department-wide, the reminders are sent out, but there are also individual reminders when officers are found to not be wearing a mask.
So has the police bureau, has the Department of Public Safety been pretty fortunate when it comes to compared to other police bureaus across the country in terms of the numbers of those infected?
Other departments have seen at times, 10 to 20, 25% of their entire police departments being affected by COVID-19, and we haven't experienced that. And I'd say we've been very fortunate. We haven't, in my memory, over the last 5 months, we've had one public safety official who became seriously ill and required hospitalization. And besides that, the other positives were generally mild cases. We're hoping that we remain vigilant and the numbers continue to stay down.
Chris Tonieri is the public information officer for the City of Pittsburgh's Department of Public Safety. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Public Schools delayed their August 31 start date to September 8th. The reason? A lack of devices. Virtual school in the midst of the pandemic is a reality for families across the country. And while a lot of instruction can be adapted to a Zoom classroom, some learning experiences have to happen in person. Technical schools and apprenticeships teach future pipe fitters, carpenters, electricians, and many other professions, all often in person. Kenneth Broadbent is the business manager for Steamfitters Local 449. Kenneth, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for inviting me to call.
Apprenticeship programs are often hands-on. Will Steamfitters 449's apprenticeship program continue as normal, or are you offering some kind of a hybrid instruction model?
Well, we're actually doing both. After around 8 weeks after COVID-19 hit, our instructors went back after 6 weeks, but then we brought the students back. But we did it keeping physical distances in all the classrooms, making sure they were 6 foot apart. But we followed what the hospitals were doing. We took people's temperature. We had them fill a form out, making sure that they didn't have symptoms before or weren't in different locations, and made sure they wore a mask when they come into the building. So everybody shows, does the same type of procedure as going into any hospital. And then in the classrooms, they stayed 6 foot apart. Now, on some of our service classes, we went to iPads where they did virtual learning for the various service classes. That's about 50 different apprentices for that. The other 400 apprentices, some of them are being taught welding, and we had to go to extremes of cleaning all the booths and our welding instructors wearing masks with fresh air packs so that they didn't transmit anything or didn't get anything from the students. And then a lot of our other classrooms or hands-on where they're working on heating and air conditioning refrigeration equipment where we kept the distance learning. So it's been a task for our classrooms, making sure we made them smaller and split up the students to make sure they were 6 foot apart.
Can you have the instructor and the student be apart, though? Sometimes it's so helpful, and I guess maybe speeds up the learning process, if they're side by side, putting their hands on the equipment, whatever they're working on.
Well, it's harder to do hands-on equipment training with the instructor and the student. So you might have to have the student back off 6 foot, show them physically what you're doing with your hands, and then the instructor back off and let the student walk in. In lecturing, they're always 6 to 8 foot apart from the classroom, and the instructors naturally always have masks on. We've also got a hand cleaner there all the time for people to do it.
Are you worried about the apprenticeship progression maybe slowing because of the pandemic and some of the changes that you've had to make for the instruction?
Slightly, but we've really adjusted and come back strong to where we've made our classes smaller, but they're still getting the same amount of hours. They're still getting hands-on training. The majority of our members are back to work. So the industry, as far as construction, union construction, we're back to real close to normal, but following the COVID-19 guidelines the CDC has set up.
Can you give us an example of something that you teach students that is just impossible to learn through a video chat?
Well, absolutely. So teaching welding, there's only one way to do it, and that's an instructor in there welding and then watching the student weld. Then you've got other times where you're soldering or you're silphossing or you're using a multimeter where it's tough to be separated too far apart from each other. So you're using anything you can to make sure that you don't spread any germs by either touching or by inhaling them.
Kenneth, Pennsylvania and the country are seeing historic unemployment. Have you seen more interest in your programs as students and residents are faced with a daunting job market?
Well, I think it was starting to happen before COVID-19. So the last couple of years, I think we've seen more parents guiding their sons or daughters to look at the trades or look at other types of occupations where you're going to be able to get a job. The trick in life and what parents want is their kids to have a job as good as them or better or to have health coverage and retirement vehicles. And it might not necessarily mean college is the route to go and end up with college debt.
Kenneth Broadbent is the business manager for Steam Fitters Local 449. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate the call.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovic, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.